glass. Honey, too, in a section of comb on a glass saucer. The maid squeezed the aromatic juice from an orange into a chilled goblet while I watched her as I lay in the lazy midday bed of the rich. Yet nothing, this morning, gave me more than a fleeting pleasure except to hear that the piano tuner had been at work already. When the maid told me that, I sprang out of bed and pulled on my old serge skirt and flannel blouse, costume of a student in which I felt far more at ease with myself than in any of my fine new clothes. After my 3 hours of practice, I called the piano tuner in to thank him. He was blind, of course, but young, with a gentle mouth and grey eyes that fixed upon me although they could not see me. He was a blacksmith's son from the village across the causeway, a chorister in the church whom the good priest had taught a trade so that he could make a living, all most satisfactory. Yes, he thought he would be happy here, and if, he added shyly, he might sometimes be allowed to hear me play, for you see he loved music. Yes, of course, I said. Certainly. He seemed to know that I had smiled. After I dismissed him, even though I'd woken so late, it was still barely time for my 5 o'clock. The housekeeper, who, thoughtfully forewarned by my husband, had restrained herself from interrupting my music, now made me a solemn visitation with a lengthy menu for a late luncheon. When I told her I did not need it, she looked at me obliquely along her nose. I understood at once that one of my principal functions as chatelaine was to provide work for the staff. But, all the same, I asserted myself and said I would wait until dinner time, although I looked forward nervously to the solitary meal. Then I found I had to tell her what I would like to have prepared for me. My imagination, still that of a schoolgirl, ran riot. A fowl in cream? Or should I anticipate Christmas with a varnished turkey? No, I have decided. Avocado and shrimp. Lots of it, followed by no entree at all, but surprise me for dessert with every ice cream in the icebox. She noted all down, but sniffed. I'd shocked her. Such tastes. Child that I was, I giggled when she left me. But now, what shall I do now? I could have spent a happy hour unpacking the trunks that contained my trousseau, but the maid had done that already. The dresses, the tailor-maids hung in the wardrobe in my dressing room, the hats on wooden heads to keep their shape, the shoes on wooden feet, as if all these inanimate objects were imitating the appearance of life to mock me. I did not like to linger in my overcrowded dressing room, nor in my lugubriously lily-scented bedroom. How shall I pass the time? I shall take a bath in my own bathroom, and found the taps were little dolphins made of gold, with chips of turquoise for eyes. And there was a tank of goldfish who swam in and out of moving fronds of weeds, as bored, I thought, as I was. How I wished he had not left me. How I wished it were possible to chat with, say, a maid, or the piano tuner. But I knew already my new rank forbade overtures of friendship to the staff. I had been hoping to defer the call as long as I could, so that I should have something to look forward to in the dead waste of time I foresaw before me after my dinner was done with. But at 7:15, when darkness already surrounded the castle, I could contain myself no longer. I telephoned my mother and astonished myself by bursting into tears when I heard her voice.
No, nothing was the matter. Mother, I have gold bath taps. I said gold bath taps. No, I suppose that's nothing to cry about, Mother.
The line was bad. I could hardly make out her congratulations, her questions, her concern, but I was a little comforted when I put the receiver down. Yet there still remained one whole hour to dinner, and the whole unimaginable desert of the rest of the evening. The bunch of keys lay, where he had left them, on the rug before the library fire, which had warmed their metal so that they no longer felt cold to the touch, but warm, almost, as my own skin. How careless I was! A maid, tending the logs, eyed me reproachfully, as if I'd set a trap for her as I picked up the clinking bundle of keys, the keys to the interior doors of this lovely prison of which I was both the inmate and the mistress, and had scarcely seen. When I remembered that, I felt the exhilaration of the explorer. Lights! More lights! At the touch of a switch, the dreaming library was brilliantly illuminated. I ran crazily about the castle, switching on every light I could find. I ordered the servants to light up all their quarters too, so the castle would shine like a seaborne birthday cake lit with 1,000 candles, one for every year of its life, and everybody on shore would wonder at it. When everything was lit as brightly as the cafe in the Gare du Nord, the significance of the possessions implied by that bunch of keys no longer intimidated me. For I was determined, now, to search through them all for evidence of my husband's true nature. His office first, evidently. A mahogany desk, half a mile wide, with an impeccable blotter and a bank of telephones. I allowed myself the luxury of opening the safe that contained the jewellery, and delved sufficiently among the leather boxes to find out how my marriage had given me access to a djinn's treasury. Parure, bracelets, rings. While I was thus surrounded by diamonds, a maid knocked on the door and entered before I spoke. A subtle discourtesy. I would speak to my husband about it. She eyed my serge skirt superciliously. "Did Madame plan to dress for dinner?" She made a moue of disdain when I laughed to hear that. She was far more the lady than I. But imagine, to dress up in one of my Poiret extravaganzas, with the jewelled turban and aigrette on my head, roped with pearl to the navel, to sit down all alone in the baronial dining hall at the head of that massive board at which King Mark was reputed to have fed his knights. I grew calmer under the cold eye of her disapproval. I adopted the crisp inflections of an officer's daughter. No, I would not dress for dinner. Furthermore, I was not hungry enough for dinner itself. She must tell the housekeeper to cancel the dormitory feast I'd ordered. Could they leave me sandwiches and a flask of coffee in my music room? And would they all dismiss for the night?
Mais oui, madame.
I knew by her bereft intonation I had let them down again, but I did not care. I was armed against them by the brilliance of his hoard, but I would not find his heart amongst the glittering stones. As soon as she had gone, I began a systematic search of the drawers of his desk. All was in order, so I found nothing. Not a random doodle on an old envelope, nor the faded photograph of a woman. Only the files of business correspondence, the bills from the home farms, the invoices from tailors, the billets doux from international financiers. Nothing. And this absence of the evidence of his real life began to impress me strangely. There must, I thought, be a great deal to conceal if he takes such pains to hide it. His office was a singularly impersonal room, facing inwards onto the courtyard, as though he wanted to turn his back on the siren sea, in order to keep a clear head while he bankrupted a small businessman in Amsterdam, or, I noticed with a thrill of distaste, engaged in some business in Laos that must, from certain cryptic references to his amateur botanist's enthusiasm for rare poppies, be to do with opium. Was he not rich enough to do without crime? Or was the crime itself his profit? And yet I saw enough to appreciate his zeal for secrecy. Now I had ransacked his desk, I must spend a cool-headed quarter of an hour putting every last letter back where I had found it. And, as I covered the traces of my visit, by some chance, as I reached inside a little drawer that had stuck fast, I must have touched a hidden spring. For a secret drawer flew open within that drawer itself, and this secret drawer contained, at last, a file marked personal. I was alone, but for my reflection in the uncurtained window. I had the brief notion that his heart, pressed flat as a flower, crimson and thin as tissue paper, lay in this file. It was a very thin one. I could have wished, perhaps, I had not found that touching, ill-spelt note on a paper napkin marked La Coupole that began,
"My darling, I cannot wait for the moment when you make me yours completely."
The diva had sent him a page of the score of Tristan, the Liebstadt, with the single cryptic word, "until," scrawled across it. But the strangest of all these love letters was a postcard with a view of a village graveyard among mountains where some black-coated ghoul enthusiastically dug at a grave. This little scene, executed with the lurid exuberance of Grand Guignol, was captioned, "Typical Transylvanian scene, midnight, All Hallows," and on the other side, the message, "On the occasion of this marriage to the descendant of Dracula, always remember, the supreme and unique pleasure of love is the certainty that one is doing evil. Toute amitié, si." A joke. A joke in the worst possible taste, for had he not been married to a Romanian countess? And then I remembered her pretty, witty face and her name, Carmilla. My most recent predecessor in this castle had been, it would seem, the most sophisticated. I put away the file, sobered. Nothing in my life of family love and music had prepared me for these grown-up games, and yet these were clues to his self that showed me, at least, how much he had been loved, even if they did not reveal any good reason for it. But I wanted to know still more. And, as I closed the office door and locked it, the means to discover more fell in my way. Fell, indeed. And with the clatter of a dropped canteen of cutlery, for, as I turned the slick Yale lock, I contrived, somehow, to open up the keyring itself, so that all the keys tumbled loose on the floor. And the very first key I picked out of that pile was, as luck or ill fortune had it, the key to the room he had forbidden me. The room he would keep for his own, so that he could go there when he wished to feel himself once more a bachelor. I made my decision to explore it before I felt a faint resurgence of my ill-defined fear of his waxen stillness. Perhaps I half imagined then that I might find his real self in his den, waiting there to see if indeed I had obeyed him. That he had sent a moving figure of himself to New York, the enigmatic, self-sustaining carapace of his public person, while the real man, whose face I had glimpsed in the storm of orgasm, occupied himself with pressing private business in the study at the foot of the West Tower, behind the still room. Yet if that was so, it was imperative that I should find him, should know him, and I was too deluded by his apparent taste for me to think my disobedience might truly offend him. I took the forbidden key from the heap and left the others lying there. It was now very late, and the castle was adrift, as far as it could go from the land, in the middle of the silent ocean, where, at my orders, it floated like a garland of light. And all silent, all still, but for the murmuring of the waves. I felt no fear. No intimation of dread. Now I walked as firmly as I had done in my mother's house. Not a narrow, dusty little passage at all. Why had he lied to me? But an ill-lit one, certainly. The electricity, for some reason, did not extend here, so I retreated to the still room and found a bundle of wax tapers in a cupboard. Stored there with matches to light the oak board at grand dinners. I put a match to my little taper and advanced with it in my hand, like a penitent, along the corridor, hung with heavy, I think, Venetian tapestries. The flame picked out here the head of a man, there the rich breast of a woman spilling through a rent in her dress, the rape of the Sabines, perhaps. The naked swords and immolated horses suggested some grisly mythological subject. The corridor wound downwards. There was an almost imperceptible ramp to the thickly carpeted floor. The heavy hangings on the wall muffled my footsteps, even my breathing. For some reason, it grew very warm. The sweat sprang out in beads on my brow. I could no longer hear the sound of the sea. Along a winding corridor, as if I were in the viscera of the castle. And this corridor led to a door of worm-eaten oak, low, round-topped, barred with black iron. And still I felt no fear, no raising of the hairs on the back of the neck, no prickling of the thumbs. The key slid into the new lock as easily as a hot knife into butter. No fear, but a hesitation, a holding of the spiritual breath. If I had found some traces of his heart in a file marked personal, perhaps here, in his subterranean privacy, I might find a little of his soul. It was the consciousness of the possibility of such a discovery, of its possible strangeness, that kept me for a moment motionless. Before, in the foolhardiness of my already subtly tainted innocence, I turned the key and the door creaked slowly back. There is a striking resemblance between the act of love and the ministrations of a torturer. Opined my husband's favourite poet. I had learned something of the nature of that similarity on my marriage bed, and now my taper showed me the outlines of a rack. There was also a great wheel, like the ones I had seen in woodcuts of the martyrdoms of the saints, in my old nurse's little store of holy books. And, just one glimpse of it before my little flame caved in and I was left in absolute darkness. A metal figure, hinged at the side, which I knew to be spiked on the inside, and to have the name, the Iron Maiden. Absolute darkness. And, about me, the instruments of mutilation. Until that moment, this spoiled child did not know she had inherited nerves and a will from the mother who had defied the yellow outlaws of Indochina. My mother's spirit drove me on, into that dreadful place, in a cold ecstasy to know the very worst. I fumbled for the matches in my pocket. What a dim, lugubrious light they gave. And yet, enough. Oh, more than enough, to see a room designed for desecration and some dark night of unimaginable lovers whose embraces were annihilation. The walls of this stark torture chamber were the naked rock. They gleamed as if they were sweating with fright. At the four corners of the room were funerary urns of great antiquity, Etruscan perhaps, and on three-legged ebony stands, the bowls of incense he had left burning, which filled the room with a sacerdotal reek. Wheel, rack, and Iron Maiden were, I saw, displayed as grandly as if they were items of statuary. And I was almost consoled then, and almost persuaded myself that I might have stumbled only upon a little museum of his perversity, that he had installed these monstrous items here only for contemplation. Yet at the centre of the room lay a catafalque, a doomed, ominous bier of Renaissance workmanship, surrounded by long white candles and, at its foot, an armful of the same lilies with which he had filled my bedroom, stowed in a four-foot-high jar, glazed with a sombre Chinese red. I scarcely dared examine this catafalque and its occupant more closely. Yet I knew I must. Each time I struck a match to light those candles round her bed, it seemed a garment of that innocence of mine for which he had lusted, fell away from me. The opera singer lay, quite naked, under a thin sheet of very rare and precious linen, such as the princes of Italy used to shroud those whom they had poisoned. I touched her, very gently, on the white breast. She was cool. He had embalmed her. On her throat, I could see the blue imprint of his strangler's fingers. The cool, sad flame of the candles flickered on her white, closed eyelids. The worst thing was, the dead lips smiled. Beyond the catafalque, in the middle of the shadows, a white, nacreous glimmer. As my eyes accustomed themselves to the gathering darkness, I, at last, oh horrors, made out a skull. Yes, a skull so utterly denuded now of flesh that it scarcely seemed possible the stark bone had once been richly upholstered with life. And this skull was strung up by a system of unseen cords so that it appeared to hang disembodied in the still, heavy air. And it had been crowned with a wreath of white roses and a veil of lace, the final image of his bride. Yet the skull was still so beautiful, had shaped with its sheer plane so imperiously the face that had once existed above it, that I recognized her the moment I saw her. Face of the evening star walking on the rim of night. One false step, oh, my poor, dear girl, next in the fated sisterhood of his wives, one false step, and into the abyss of the dark you stumbled. And where was she, the latest dead? The Romanian countess, who might have thought her blood would survive his depredations. I knew she must be here, in the place that had wound me through the castle towards it on a spool of inexorability. But at first, I could see no sign of her. Then, for some reason, perhaps some change of atmosphere wrought by my presence, the metal shell of the Iron Maiden emitted a ghostly twang. My feverish imagination might have guessed its occupant was trying to clamber out, though even in the midst of my rising hysteria, I knew she must be dead to find a home there. With trembling fingers, I prized open the front of the upright coffin, with its sculpted face caught in a rictus of pain. Then, overcome, I dropped the key I still held in my other hand. It dropped into the foaming pool of her blood. She was pierced, not by one, but by 100 spikes. This child of the land of the vampires, who seemed so newly dead, so full of blood. Oh, God! How recently had he become a widower? How long had he kept her in this obscene cell? Had it been all the time he had courted me in the clear light of Paris? I closed the lid of her coffin very gently and burst into a tumult of sobbing that contained both pity for his other victims and also a dreadful anguish to know I too was one of them. The candles flared as if in a draught from a door to elsewhere. The light caught the fire opal on my hand so that it flashed once with a baleful light as if to tell me the eye of God, his eye, was upon me. My first thought when I saw the ring for which I had sold myself to this fate was how to escape it. I retained sufficient presence of mind to snuff out the candles round the bier with my fingers, to gather up my taper, to look around, although shuddering, to ensure I had left behind me no traces of my visit. I retrieved the key from the pool of blood, wrapped it in my handkerchief to keep my hands clean, and fled the room, slamming the door behind me. It crashed to with a juddering reverberation, like the door of hell. I could not take refuge in my bedroom, for that retained the memory of his presence trapped in the fathomless silvering of his mirrors. My music room seemed the safest place, although I looked at the picture of Saint Cecilia with a faint dread. What had been the nature of her martyrdom? My mind was in a tumult. Schemes for flight jostled with one another. As soon as the tide receded from the causeway, I would make for the mainland, on foot, running, stumbling. I did not trust that leather-clad chauffeur, nor the well-behaved housekeeper, and I dared not take any of the pale, ghostly maids into my confidence either, since they were his creatures, all. Once at the village, I would fling myself directly on the mercy of the gendarmerie. But could I trust them either? His forefathers had ruled this coast for 8 centuries, from this castle whose moat was the Atlantic. Might not the police, the advocates, even the judge, all be in his service, turning a common blind eye to his vices, since he was milord, whose word must be obeyed? Who, on this distant coast, would believe the white-faced girl from Paris, who came running to them with a shuddering tale of blood, of fear, of the ogre murmuring in the shadows? Or rather, they would immediately know it to be true, but were all on a bound to let me carry it no further. Assistance. My mother. I ran to the telephone, and the line, of course, was dead. Dead as his wives. A thick darkness, unlit by any star, still glazed the windows. Every lamp in my room burned to keep the dark outside, yet it seemed still to encroach on me, to be present beside me, but as if masked by my lights, the night like a permeable substance that could seep into my skin. I looked at the precious little clock made from hypocritically innocent flowers long ago in Dresden. The hands had scarcely moved one single hour forward from when I had first descended to that private slaughterhouse of his. Time was his servant too, It would trap me, here, in a night that would last until he came back to me, like a black sun on a hopeless morning. And yet the time might still be my friend. At that hour, that very hour, he set sail for New York. To know that in a few moments my husband would have left France calmed my agitation a little. My reason told me I had nothing to fear. The tide that would take him away to the new world would let me out of the imprisonment of the castle. Surely I could easily evade the servants. Anybody can buy a ticket at a railway station. Yet I was still filled with unease. I opened the lid of the piano. Perhaps I thought my own particular magic might help me, now that I could create a pentacle out of music that would keep me from harm, for if my music had first ensnared him, then might it not also give me the power to free myself from him? Mechanically, I began to play, but my fingers were stiff and shaking. At first, I could manage nothing better than the exercises of Czerny, but simply the act of playing soothed me, and, for solace, for the sake of the harmonious rationality of its sublime mathematics, I searched among his scores until I found the well-tempered clavier. I set myself the therapeutic task of playing all Bach's equations, every one, and I told myself if I played them all through without a single mistake, then the morning would find me once more a virgin. Crash of a dropped stick. His silver-headed cane. What else? Sly, cunning, he had returned. He was waiting for me outside the door. I rose to my feet. Fear gave me strength. I flung back my head defiantly. Come in! My voice astonished me by its firmness, its clarity. The door slowly, nervously opened, and I saw not the massive, irredeemable bulk of my husband, but the slight stooping figure of the piano tuner. And he looked far more terrified of me than my mother's daughter would have been of the devil himself. In the torture chamber, it seemed to me that I would never laugh again. Now, helplessly, laugh I did, with relief, and, after a moment's hesitation, the boy's face softened, and he smiled a little, almost in shame. Though they were blind, his eyes were singularly sweet.
"Forgive me," said Jean-Yves. "I know I've given you grounds for dismissing me, that I should be crouching outside your door at midnight. But I heard you walking about, up and down. I sleep in a room at the foot of the West Tower, and some intuition told me you could not sleep and might, perhaps, pass the insomniac hours at your piano. And I could not resist that. Besides, I stumbled over these." And he displayed the ring of keys I'd dropped outside my husband's office door, the ring from which one key was missing. I took them from him, looked round for a place to stow them, fixed on the piano stool as if to hide them would protect me. Still he stood smiling at me. How hard it was to make everyday conversation. "It's perfect," I said. "The piano, perfectly in tune." But he was full of the loquacity of embarrassment, as though I would only forgive him for his impudence if he explained the cause of it thoroughly. "When I heard you play this afternoon, I thought I'd never heard such a touch, such technique. A treat for me to hear a virtuoso. So I crept up to your door now, humbly as a little dog might, madame, and put my ear to the keyhole and listened. And listened. Until my stick fell to the floor through a momentary clumsiness of mine. And I was discovered." He had the most touchingly ingenuous smile.
perfectly in tune,
I repeated. To my surprise, now I had said it, I found I could not say anything else. I could only repeat,
in tune, perfect in tune,
over and over again. I saw a dawning surprise in his face. My head throbbed. To see him, in his lovely, blind humanity, seemed to hurt me very piercingly, somewhere inside my breast. His figure blurred. The room swayed about me. After the dreadful revelation of that bloody chamber, it was his tender look that made me faint. When I recovered consciousness, I found I was lying in the piano tuner's arms, and he was tucking the satin cushion from the piano stool under my head.
"You are in some great distress," he said. "No bride should suffer so much, so early in her marriage."
His speech had the rhythms of the countryside, the rhythms of the tides.
"Any bride brought to this castle should come ready dressed in mourning, should bring a priest and a coffin with her," I said. "What's this?"
It was too late to keep silent, and if he too were one of my husband's creatures, then at least he had been kind to me. So I told him everything. The keys, the interdiction, my disobedience, the room, the rack, the skull, the corpses, the blood.
"I can scarcely believe it," he said, wondering.
"That man! So rich! So well born!"
"Here's proof,"
I said, and tumbled the fatal key out of my handkerchief onto the silken rug.
"Oh, God," he said. "I can smell the blood."
He took my hand. He pressed his arms about me. Although he was scarcely more than a boy, I felt a great strength flow into me from his touch.
"We whisper all manner of strange tales up and down the coast," he said. "There was a marquis once who used to hunt young girls on the mainland. He hunted them with dogs, as though they were foxes. My grandfather had it from his grandfather, how the marquis pulled a head out of his saddlebag and showed it to the blacksmith while the man was shoeing his horse. 'A fine specimen of the genus. Brunette, eh, Guillaume?' And it was the head of the blacksmith's wife."
But in these more democratic times, my husband must travel as far as Paris to do his hunting in the salons. Jean-Yves knew the moment I shuddered.
"Oh, madame, I thought all these were old wives' tales, chattering of fools, spooks to scare bad children into good behavior. Yet how could you know, a stranger, that the old name for this place is the Castle of Murder?"
How could I know indeed, except that in my heart I'd always known its lord would be the death of me.
"Hark," said my friend suddenly, "the sea has changed key. It must be near morning. The tide is going down."
He helped me up. I looked from the window towards the mainland, across the causeway where the stones gleamed wetly in the thin light of the end of the night, and, with an almost unimaginable horror, a horror of the intensity of which I cannot transmit to you, I saw, in the distance, still far away, yet drawing moment by moment inexorably nearer, the twin headlamps of his great black car, gouging tunnels through the shifting mist. My husband had indeed returned. This time, it was no fancy.
"The key," said Jean-Yves. "It must go back on the ring, with the others, as though nothing had happened."
but the key was still caked with wet blood, and I ran to my bathroom and held it under the hot tap. Crimson water swirled down the basin, but, as if the key itself were hurt, the bloody token stuck. The turquoise eyes of the dolphin taps winked at me derisively. They knew my husband had been too clever for me. I scrubbed the stain with my nail brush, but still it would not budge. I thought how the car would be rolling silently towards the closed courtyard gate. The more I scrubbed the key, the more vivid grew the stain. The bell in the gatehouse would jangle. The porter's drowsy son would push back the patchwork quilt, yawning, pull the shirt over his head, thrust his feet into his sabots. Slowly, slowly, open the door for your master as slowly as you can. And still the bloodstain mocked the fresh water that spilled from the mouth of the leering dolphin.
"You have no more time," said Jean-Yves. "He is here. I know it. I must stay with you."
"You shall not," I said. "Go back to your room now, please." He hesitated. I put an edge of steel in my voice, for I knew I must meet my lord alone.
"Leave me."
As soon as he had gone, I dealt with the keys and went to my bedroom. The causeway was empty. Jean-Yves was correct. My husband had already entered the castle. I pulled the curtains close, stripped off my clothes, and pulled the bed curtain around me, as a pungent aroma of Russian leather assured me my husband was once again beside me.
"Dearest." With the most treacherous, lascivious tenderness, he kissed my eyes, and, mimicking the new bride newly wakened, I flung my arms around him, for on my seeming acquiescence depended my salvation.
"De Silva of Rio outwitted me," he said wryly. "My New York agent telegraphed Le Havre and saved me a wasted journey. So we may resume our interrupted pleasures, my love."
I did not believe one word of it. I knew I had behaved exactly according to his desires. Had he not bought me so that I should do so? I had been tricked into my own betrayal to that illimitable darkness whose source I had been compelled to seek in his absence, and, now that I had met that shadowed reality of his that came to life only in the presence of its own atrocities, I must pay the price of my new knowledge. The secret of Pandora's box. But he had given me the box, himself, knowing I must learn the secret. I had played a game in which every move was governed by a destiny as oppressive and omnipotent as himself, since that destiny was himself. And I had lost. Lost at that charade of innocence and vice in which he had engaged me, lost as the victim loses to the executioner. His hand brushed my breast beneath the sheet. I strained my nerves, yet could not help but flinch from the intimate touch. For it made me think of the piercing embrace of the Iron Maiden and of his lost lovers in the vault. When he saw my reluctance, his eyes veiled over, and yet his appetite did not diminish. His tongue ran over red lips already wet. Silent, mysterious, he moved away from me to draw off his jacket. He took the gold watch from his waistcoat and laid it on the dressing table, like a good bourgeois. Scooped out his rattling loose change, and now, oh God, makes a great play of patting his pockets officiously, puzzled lips pursed, searching for something that has been mislaid. Then turns to me with a ghastly, a triumphant smile.
"But of course, I gave the keys to you.
Your keys? Why, of course. Here, they're under the pillow. Wait a moment. What? Ah! No. Now, where can I have left them? I was whiling away the evening without you at the piano, I remember. Of course, the music room.
Brusquely, he flung my negligee of antique lace on the bed. Go and get them.
Now? This moment? Can't it wait until morning, my darling?
I forced myself to be seductive. I saw myself, pale, pliant as a plant that begs to be trampled underfoot. A dozen vulnerable, appealing girls reflected in as many mirrors, and I saw how he almost failed to resist me. If he had come to me in bed, I would have strangled him then. But he half snarled,
No, it won't wait. Now.
The unearthly light of dawn filled the room. Had only one previous dawn broken upon me in that vile place, and there was nothing for it but to go and fetch the keys from the music stool and pray he would not examine them too closely. Pray to God his eyes would fail him, that he might be struck blind. When I came back into the bedroom, carrying the bunch of keys that jangled at every step like a curious musical instrument, he was sitting on the bed in his immaculate shirt sleeves, his head sunk in his hands. And it seemed to me he was in despair. Strange. In spite of my fear of him that made me whiter than my wrap, I felt there emanate from him, at that moment, a stench of absolute despair, rank and ghastly, as if the lilies that surrounded him had all at once begun to fester, or the Russian leather of his scent were reverting to the elements of flayed hide and excrement of which it was composed. The thonic gravity of his presence exerted a tremendous pressure on the room, so that the blood pounded in my ears as if we had been precipitated to the bottom of the sea, beneath the waves that pounded against the shore. I held my life in my hands amongst those keys, and, in a moment, would place it between his well-manicured fingers. The evidence of that bloody chamber had showed me I could expect no mercy. Yet, when he raised his head and stared at me with his blind, shuttered eyes as though he did not recognize me, I felt a terrified pity for him, for this man who lived in such strange, secret places that, if I loved him enough to follow him, I should have to die. The atrocious loneliness of that monster. The monocle had fallen from his face. His curling mane was disordered, as if he had run his hands through it in his distraction. I saw how he had lost his impassivity and was now filled with suppressed excitement. The hand he stretched out for those counters in his game of love and death shook a little. The face that turned towards me contained a somber delirium that seemed to me compounded of a ghastly, yes, shame, but also of a terrible, guilty joy as he slowly ascertained how I had sinned. That telltale stain had resolved itself into a mark the shape and brilliance of the heart on a playing card. He disengaged the key from the ring and looked at it for a while, solitary, brooding. It is the key that leads to the kingdom of the unimaginable, he said. His voice was low and had in it the timbre of certain great cathedral organs that seem, when they are played, to be conversing with God. I could not restrain a sob. Oh, my love, my little love,
who brought me a white gift of music," he said, almost as if grieving. "My little love, you'll never know how much I hate daylight." Then he sharply ordered, "Kneel!" I knelt before him, and he pressed the key lightly to my forehead, held it there for a moment. I felt a faint tingling of the skin, and, when I involuntarily glanced at myself in the mirror, I saw the heart-shaped stain had transferred itself to my forehead, to the space between the eyebrows, like the caste mark of a Brahmin woman, or the mark of Cain. And now the key gleamed as freshly as if it had just been cut. He clipped it back on the ring, emitting that same heavy sigh as he had done when I said that I would marry him. "My virgin of the arpeggios, prepare yourself for martyrdom."
"What form shall it take?" I said.
"Decapitation,"
he whispered, almost voluptuously.
"Go and bathe yourself. Put on that white dress you wore to hear Tristan, and the necklace that prefigures your end. And I shall take myself off to the armory, my dear, to sharpen my great-grandfather's ceremonial sword."
"The servants?"
"We shall have absolute privacy for our last rites. I have already dismissed them. If you look out of the window, you can see them going to the mainland."
It was now the full pale light of morning. The weather was grey, indeterminate. The sea had an oily, sinister look, a gloomy day on which to die. Along the causeway, I could see trooping every maid and scullion, every potboy and panscourer, valet, laundress and vassal who worked in that great house, most on foot, a few on bicycles. The faceless housekeeper trudged along with a great basket in which, I guessed, she'd stowed as much as she could ransack from the larder. The Marquis must have given the chauffeur leave to borrow the motor for the day, for it went last of all at a stately pace, as though the procession were a cortege and the car already bore my coffin to the mainland for burial. But I knew no good Breton earth would cover me like a last faithful lover. I had another fate.
"I have given them all a day's holiday to celebrate our wedding," he said, and smiled.
However hard I stared at the receding company, I could see no sign of Jean-Yves, our latest servant, hired but the preceding morning.
"Go, now, bathe yourself, dress yourself, the lustratory ritual and the ceremonial robing. After that, the sacrifice. Wait in the music room until I telephone for you. No, my dear," and he smiled as I started, recalling the line was dead, "one may call inside the castle just as much as one pleases, but outside, never."
I scrubbed my forehead with the nail brush as I had scrubbed the key, but this red mark would not go away either, no matter what I did, and I knew I should wear it until I died, though that would not be long. Then I went to my dressing room and put on that white muslin shift, costume of a victim of an auto da fe he had bought me to listen to the Liebestodt in. 12 young women combed out 12 listless sheaves of brown hair in the mirrors. Soon there would be none. The mass of lilies that surrounded me exhaled now the odour of their withering. They looked like the trumpets of the angels of death. On the dressing table, coiled like a snake about to strike, lay the ruby choker. Already almost lifeless, cold at heart, I descended the spiral staircase to the music room. But there, I found I had not been abandoned.
"I can be of some comfort to you," the boy said, "though not much use."
We pushed the piano stool in front of the open window so that, for as long as I could, I would be able to smell the ancient, reconciling smell of the sea that, in time, will cleanse everything, scour the old bones white, wash away all the stains. The last little chambermaid had trotted along the causeway long ago, and now the tide, fated as I, came tumbling in, the crisp wavelets splashing on the old stones.
"You do not deserve this," he said.
"Who can say what I deserve or no?" I said. "I've done nothing, but that may be sufficient reason for condemning me."
"You disobeyed him," he said. "That is sufficient reason for him to punish you."
"I only did what he knew I would."
"Like Eve," he said.
The telephone rang a shrill imperative.
"Let it ring."
But my lover lifted me up and set me on my feet. I knew I must answer it. The receiver felt heavy as earth.
"The courtyard. Immediately."
My lover kissed me. He took my hand. He would come with me if I would lead him.
Courage.
When I thought of courage, I thought of my mother. Then I saw a muscle in my lover's face quiver.
"Hoofbeats," he said.
I cast one last, desperate glance from the window. And, like a miracle, I saw a horse and rider galloping at a vertiginous speed along the causeway, though the waves crashed now, high as the horse's fetlocks. A rider, her black skirts tucked up around her waist so she could ride hard and fast, a crazy, magnificent horsewoman in widow's weeds. As the telephone rang again.
"Am I to wait all morning?"
Every moment, my mother drew nearer.
"She will be too late,"
Jean-Yves said, and yet he could not restrain a note of hope that, though it must be so, yet it might not be so. The third, intransigent call.
"Shall I come up to heaven to fetch you down, Saint Cecilia?" "You wicked woman! Do you wish me to compound my crimes by desecrating the marriage bed?"
So I must go to the courtyard, where my husband waited in his London-tailored trousers and the shirt from Turnbull and Asser, beside the mounting block, with, in his hand, the sword which his great-grandfather had presented to the little corporal in token of surrender to the Republic before he shot himself. The heavy sword, unsheathed, grey as that November morning, sharp as childbirth. Mortal. When my husband saw my companion, he observed,
"Let the blind lead the blind, eh? But does even a youth as besotted as you are think she was truly blind to her own desires when she took my ring? Give it me back, whore!"
The fires in the opal had all died down. I gladly slipped it from my finger, and, even in that dolorous place, my heart was lighter for the lack of it. My husband took it lovingly and lodged it on the tip of his little finger. It would go no further.
"It will serve me for a dozen more fiancées," he said. "To the block, woman! No! Leave the boy. I shall deal with him later, utilizing a less exalted instrument than the one with which I do my wife the honor of her immolation, for do not fear that in death you will be divided."
Slowly, slowly, one foot before the other, I crossed the cobbles. The longer I dawdled over my execution, the more time it gave the avenging